Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's programme, we'll be speaking to Nobel Prize winning cosmologist about our expanding universe. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. We get to all of your comments at the end of the podcast. It's time, as always, to look back at some of the breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shane Bergen of UCD and from the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies, Dr. Laura Hayes. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with Uranus, Laura. This is quite an interesting story because I was way older than I probably should have been when I realized that a day is not the same amount of time on other planets as it is on Earth.
Yeah, for sure. So this is a really interesting study that came out earlier this week, which basically had a new way or a new kind of measurement of looking at the rotation period of how fast that planet spins and basically tells you how long the day is. So we've actually found that the day on Uranus is actually longer than we thought it was beforehand. And Uranus is kind of this really weird planet where it's one of the weirdest ones in the solar system, right? Because most planets, they orbit kind of around their poles, like kind of in the ecliptic plane.
On a flat disk from the sun?
Yeah, exactly. Like on a flat disk, they kind of move like a spinning top, right? Mm-hmm. So up and down, like the north and south pole, and they're spinning around that, around the sun. But Uranus is actually very strange. It's actually 90 degrees the other way, meaning it's kind of orbiting like a barrel around the sun, right? So its north pole is actually facing towards the sun. Yeah, which is kind of mad.
How did it end up doing that?
So I think it was some collision early on in the solar system that, you know, something hit into it and basically knocked it on its side. And also the moons of it actually orbit that way as well. So it's super weird.
Whoa, really? Moons too?
Yeah. And it's rings. So it's one of those interesting ones.
Well, now, hang on. Wouldn't the moons eventually, if just the planet got knocked, wouldn't the moons eventually have to swing around the same way?
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't they? Because
right? Yeah, for sure.
How long is a day in Uranus?
Yeah, so a day in Uranus now is 17 hours, 14 minutes and 52 seconds. So 28 seconds longer than we previously had measured.
Come on.
Right now.
How is this a story? How did this get through our very rigorous matrix of decision making?
Yeah, excellent question, right? So you might think, you know, 30 seconds, it's not that long, right? But it's like basically having that your watch is 30 seconds slow every day, right? So 30 seconds today, not that big of a deal. Tomorrow it's a minute. The next day it's like, you know, and so on and so on. So as time progresses, you know, that difference that we measure is actually huge, right? And we use...
This is crazy. What on earth were we thinking? They're stomping around the place, you know, kicking themselves in the...
Yeah, absolutely. And so how they measure, you know, how it rotates basically is we can't really see the surface, so we can't track like a mountain and see how fast it moves around.
Why can't we see the surface of Uranus?
Yes, it's because it's covered in this big gas. It's one of these icy gas kind of things, right? So what they did is they actually measured the aurora. So the northern lights that happen on Uranus with this telescope called Hubble, and they measured in extreme ultraviolet lights. And basically the aurora or this northern lights map kind of the poles, right? And so by measuring this and seeing how that moves, we can measure basically how fast that planet is.
That's very cool.
But wait a second. If Uranus is spinning at a certain rate and the gas that's in its atmosphere is occluding our vision of the surface, mm-hmm. why is the gas not also spinning at the same rate?
Yeah, I guess it can spin. The gas is also spinning at a rate, but that can be different to the planet. And it's also very difficult to track something on the gas to see, oh, well, that's the same position. Is that moving around at the same speed as which the planet is rotating?
Right, okay.
Where the magnetic field of the planet will rotate at the same kind of speed. And the magnetic field, it basically traces out the aurora, and that's how we basically can do this measurement.
Okay, I don't understand how we had any measurement at all until we had the aurora.
Yeah, excellent. Another really, really great question.
So good at these questions, seriously.
Reviewer 2, McRae here.
So basically, you know, the measurement we kind of had in the past was by a measurement of the Voyager 2 satellite back in the late 1970s, right? Which basically, this was a spacecraft that was sent out really, really far. It's now past our solar system and into interstellar space.
That's under debate. That's
not
a bit.
Yeah.
Is it not anymore?
No, we've
it was
done
fully
multiple
gone.
Stories on this.
I know, but I thought they said where it is. They're not quite sure. It's caught them on the edge. It's a long edge, but I thought it was still somewhere on the edge. Maybe not. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Fine, fine.
Yeah, but it's out there really far.
Yeah, it's far away. It's far away. We can all agree. It's far away. I don't know why I was being pedantic about it.
Yeah. But basically, on its way out there, it passed by Uranus, right? And it actually went through, kind of went really, really close in and can measure the magnetic field there, right? So the basically measurement we had before and what we were using to kind of do all the science was based on that time from a very, very long time ago. So now these new measurements over decades of observations with Hubble of these aurora, we now have an actual really, really precise measurement of the rotation rate.
There's no reason to ever think that any of these planets will significantly in any way slow their rotation, because they're rotating in space essentially, right? So there's going to be no significant slowing down of that rate. So what the measurement that was made in the 1960s, it's probably very, very similar, if not exactly the same as the measurement we're now making 6 years later.
Yeah, like in theory, they should be exactly the same. But we have a more precise measurement.
Okay, thank you so much.
Although our day on Earth is getting longer because of the moon and water on the surface of the Earth, but it's tiny amounts. But the days are getting longer.
It does vary a little bit. Our second story, Shane, has to do with renewable energies. And this is, you know, we talk about climate change so much in the fossil fuels. This is it's a really impressive figure.
It's good news. Did you know in the 1940s that 40% of all electricity generated was from renewables?
No.
Yeah, I didn't either. It was all from hydropower, right? Now, the demand for electricity in the 1940s was low, right? It was like three radios and a light here in Ireland.
Yeah.
But since then, demand has risen. And unfortunately, we burn an awful lot of fossil fuels. But 2024 is the first time since the 1940s that 40% of the world's electricity is now generated from renewables.
That's incredible.
It is.
Yeah.
However, why
are none of your stories good news?
No, this is
actually
really good news.
No, you're pretending it's good news, but
no,
actually,
it is good news. Absolutely. Yeah. And I also wanted to do a good news story about scientists finally cracking the best way to make coffee, but you said no. So electricity demand has increased, right? This is the downside. So whilst the 40% is good, the overall amount of electricity that we need to generate is really increasing. And you know what's driving it?
Yes, I do.
The warming world. So we have to stay cold. We have to keep things cool. We need power, very intense amounts of power to keep things cold. So the concentration of carbon dioxide emitted is still rising, right? But what's really positive here is that solar power is like, and there's a bit of a Moore's Law phenomenon going on with solar power. So the amount of electricity that's generated by solar power seems to be doubling every 3 years since 2012. And it's driven primarily by China and India, increasingly so in the Western world as well. And it is massively dwarfing other forms of renewables such as wind and hydro. Not to suggest that wind isn't important in places like Ireland. It really is. But now when you land in Dublin Airport, you start to see all these solar farms below you. And isn't it amazing that we have these alternative ways of generating energy here too?
Well, Dublin Airport is actually very green.
It is.
Not the planes. It's not the planes that's in it. No, the actual airport itself, the actual building. I promise you.
No, I know
it's actually one of the standout buildings, I believe, in the country.
I know, but I hear this. This is actually used in my White Trust Science module every year.
Oh, really? Okay, so
disinformation. No, it is. The airport is green, but the airport is there to serve the most climate-intense form of transport known to humankind, aeroplanes.
Well, rockets are probably.
Well, that's true.
Anyway, look, why am I being so pedantic? I'm so sorry. Our third story.
Do you have a rocket?
I agree with the principle. I'm just being annoying. Just being
good
annoying.
Luck, Laura.
My third story, Laura, has to do with monkeypox and a possible unusual perpetrator.
Yeah. This is a really interesting story, almost like a virus Cluedo, right? So it's a study that is currently in review, and it was published in a Nature kind of article, looking at who the culprit is of carrying monkeypox around, or mpox is what it's now called. You know, in the past, we would have thought monkeypox, as the name would suggest, maybe it's related to monkeys, but that is actually, you know, a misconception. It's because it was originally found in monkeys. So the one thing is, you know, we want to find out what carries around this virus that then can be transmitted to other animals or to humans. And the culprit that they found is actually called a fire-footed rope squirrel. So the squirrel, I guess, was the perpetrator in this case of carrying this monkeypox virus and transmitting it to kind of a population of monkeys.
Although we don't know for sure that the squirrel is responsible for the wider monkeypox, this is a really interesting one because we could see that this particular observation from researchers in the field discovered that it's possible, and in this case, the perpetrator was a squirrel.
Yeah, exactly, right. So this is not saying that, of course, you know, all squirrels have monkeypox or anything like that. But in these cases, you always want to find a reservoir host. What animals carry it around, don't feel the symptoms, but pass it on. And why I said Cluedo earlier is like these were scientists that were observing a group of monkeys for various reasons. And they found out that they came out with this outbreak of monkeypox. And when they found this, they were like, oh, okay, well, how did they catch this monkeypox, this small population? And they went around the land that they were staying in, looked at, you know, different things. They checked their poop for the DNA samples of monkeypox. And nearby, only 3 kilometers away, they just happened upon a dead squirrel, right? And they actually looked at the squirrel and they tested it for this monkeypox and found almost an identical viral match. So this is kind of a case where this is very strange. And they went back and looked at videos they've been making of these monkeys over time, not necessarily related to this study, and found cases where these monkeys were actually eating those squirrels.
Monkeys were eating the squirrels?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's an image I don't really want to have in my brain.
I know. And don't actually, in the paper, there's actually a picture from the video where you can see the monkey eating the squirrel.
No.
So it's kind of like this whole thing of like, you know, was it Colonel Mustard in the boardroom? No, it was the red squirrel in the tree, you know, kind of idea. But a really interesting study, and this kind of shows the first case of really having, you know, this interspecies transmission of monkeypox.
Smoking gun for a species leap. That's pretty cool. It'd be interesting to see now when we look at monkeypox, where it first began, the patient zero of some of these, whether or not there are these sort of squirrel populations or did the squirrel get it from something else?
Exactly.
But very interesting. Our final story, Shane, has to do with lightning.
Yeah, another smoking gun. This is a particular type of tree that exists in the Panamanian rainforest, and it selectively tries to get hit by lightning. And it does so a bunch of times over its many hundred year lifespan. And as a result of that, it manages to survive for unknown reasons. Perhaps because of its size and the way it's made, but it seems to be able to transfer a lot of the current that it attracts from the lightning to wipe out species around it, and it gives it an advantage.
This sounds like such an extraordinary claim. How do they know that?
Good question. Because lightning strikes last milliseconds, and the effects that they're looking for would be years. So they noticed this happening first with a big whopper of a lightning strike. Somebody saw it hit a tree, and then noticed over the next 2 years that all the species around the tree died, or half of them died, but most of them are damaged, and the tree itself was still fine. So they sent out a ton of drones and PhD students, and they did a load of observations. And
disposable resources.
Exactly, yeah. subject to lightning strikes, etc. And they found that this theory holds. Many trees get struck by lightning, and then they managed to find one that had fallen down, and they saw that it had been struck 5 times over its 300-year lifespan, but it survived.
So are they saying it evolved an adaptation to get struck by lightning to stop the species around it from pissing it off?
So it's slightly taller than most of the trees around. That'll help, right? But trees like to do that anyway. It has a huge crown, and they suspect that it might have a structure that means it has a lower resistance so that the current can pass through it more easily, not cause as much heat damage as it goes, but that if it touches anything nearby and vines that are stuck to it that are parasitic, it's going to burn them all off.
That is very cool, isn't
it? Yeah, nature.
That is a great story to finish with. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCT and from the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies, thank you so much for joining us. What do we know about the cosmos, and how do we know it? And what mysteries remain for us to decipher? Well, I'm honoured to have our next guest on the programme. He has an upcoming talk at Maynooth University tomorrow evening, on Monday, that is. There are free tickets available on Eventbrite. He is Brian Schmidt, a Nobel Prize winning astrophysicist. He'll be giving the Dean's lecture there. He joins me now. Brian, thank you so much for coming on the programme. We have had a number of Nobel Prize winners on the show, but it's always nice to welcome another, and it's great to have you with us. Maybe you might start off talking to us a little bit about your interest in the cosmos, our universe, and how it all began.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm an astronomer, but I guess like many children, and I would even argue most children, when you go out and you look up at the stars, you just kind of want to understand what's going on. And I used to be famous with my parents asking how come. And so I guess I've had the privilege in life to be able to go and try to figure out how come. And, you know, my hope is being able to share that with the audience on Monday night. But yeah, I'm someone who gets to try to figure out, unlock why is the universe the way it is, and share that with people around the world.
Tell me a little bit about your specific interest, because the universe is a pretty big place. Where has your research really focused on?
So what I've been able to do is use exploding stars, which we call supernovae, to trace back into time what the universe has been doing. And the universe, we know, is expanding. And it turns out that by looking back in time at exploding stars, we can measure how fast the universe is expanding back in time. And we can compare what the universe does, for example, 8 billion years ago, and what does it do now? And we've always been thinking that gravity would slow the universe down because gravity pulls. And so therefore, if I measure how fast the universe is expanding, for example, 8 billion years ago, and compare it to the present day, it should be expanding slower now than what it was doing 8 billion years ago. Now, the thing that I won the Nobel Prize with a team was seeing that actually the universe has sped up over the last 8 billion years, and trying to understand why is gravity somehow pushing rather than pulling. You know, that's been a basis of my work.
So loads of questions for you, of course, on that. I suppose the first one is a really rudimentary one. People sometimes think of the universe as being infinite. And yet, if it can expand, then it is not infinite. But if the universe is expanding into something, how is that possible if there's an edge to the universe?
All right. So there sort of is and there sort of isn't an edge to the universe. There is an edge of the universe because we look back in time, and it turns out the universe was born, as we know it, 13.8 billion years ago, the Big Bang. And so as I look back further and further and further, I get closer and closer to the Big Bang. And so the universe has this edge, which is the Big Bang, back in time. And so I kind of run out of universe to look at as I look back in time. On the other hand, the universe is right now, as near as we can tell, actually infinite. So I can only see 13.8 billion years of it, but there's a whole bunch of universe I can't see, and that's because I haven't had enough time to see it. So it's kind of a confusing mixture of time and space. And it turns out you kind of got to think of all four dimensions rather than the normal three dimensions we think of in normal life to figure this all out. So that's one of the things I'll try to explain.
So these supernovae, when we look at them now, we can sort of use them as a clock or a time code on a movie. Is that the idea, that if you're watching something going forward, these supernovae expand, and if you want to figure out where they came from or how they started, you reverse what you see and watch the clock go backwards, and then you arrive at 13.8 billion and you arrive at a single point for all matter in the universe? Is that the current theory?
Yeah, that's the basic idea. So what a supernova allows me to do is to measure a distance. So if I see a object which is, for example, a billion light years away, then to first order, it turns out not exactly, but more or less, the distance tells you how far back in time you're looking. So a billion light years away means I'm looking a billion years into the past. And by looking at how much the universe has expanded over that billion years, I can then run the universe in reverse if I need to, and see that in the past, the entire universe, it turns out, was on top of itself. And again, it'll be easier for people to understand this if they actually come to my talk. And you can kind of look back into time, and everything ends up being on top of itself back in time. And that time is the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years ago.
When we say a single point, do we mean like a single, like atom-sized point in time? And when we say a single point, do we mean like a single galaxy-sized object that contained all matter? Or because I'm trying to think of the laws of physics that we have now to explain, you know, the pull on planets and all the, you know, that standard model that we have. None of that can really explain how we got something out of nothing or how we got everything out of nothing. Can it?
Yeah, well, it. Some people would say it can. I would tend to agree with you. It can't. What we can do is we can extrapolate everything we see right now. And if you take it to the nth degree, that is to the earliest time we can imagine in the universe, then everything we see right now was in a space about the size of an orange. So,
what?
Yeah, you've got everything, every galaxy, everything we see right now was in something the size of an orange. And when you get smaller than an orange, then you're really extrapolating to the point where we're pretty sure all the physics we know probably breaks. So I'm only prepared to go back to the orange. And some people would like to go even earlier than the orange.
It requires either spirituality or tools that are impossible to build. So actually, looking back as far as we can, we'll never hear, in inverted commas, the Big Bang. We'll only hear the bit after, because we're only hearing post-explosion.
I would certainly say that. I would say there are people who would disagree with me on that. But, you know,
do people disagree with Nobel Prize winning?
Oh, all the time. Indeed, we're a target, actually. And that's the beauty of science. Can I say, you may be revered as a Nobel Prize winner, but only so much. You're only good as your last sentence. So I think one of the big questions is, what is the Big Bang? And I don't think we know even what the Big Bang is. I think we could take things down when things were insanely dense, where everything in the universe is down to this orange size. And then I think we start having a range of options. And, you know, it's that, you know, that's what I call the Big Bang. But I don't really know what comes before that orange time at all. And, you know, maybe some theorists will figure a story out that will be compelling to me. But at this point, I think we have a huge range of options.
I'm loath to go down this route, but you're probably one of the best positioned people in the world to help me out. My audience is really sick of me touting this completely evidenceless position. I only mentioned it like 2 weeks ago in the program, but dark energy. So dark energy is this repulsive force that makes up about 73% of the universe, is our current widely accepted understanding of what dark energy is. I mean, not what it is, but its effect on our universe. Is that something that you have measured and observed in your work?
Yeah, I mean, that's literally what I got the Nobel Prize for. So if we want the universe to accelerate like what we have measured, the universe is speeding up, the only sensible way we can do it is to have space itself have an energy. And it turns out Einstein's theory way back to 1917, he knew that if you gave space energy, and that energy is constant over time, it will make gravity push rather than pull. Now, the fact that 70% of everything has to be this energy that is part of space, and we didn't know about it, yep, that's what my discovery is. Now, you can tweak it a little bit, and we're trying to really measure, is it doing exactly what Einstein predicted or not? I think the jury is still out. But at this point, to a couple percent at least, what Einstein would have suggested in 1917 to make sense of our observations in 1998, yeah, still seems to be holding together pretty well, but there are some cracks, and those cracks are where the interest is. You know, maybe there is something fundamentally wrong with what, you know, the very simple solution given to us by Einstein of space having energy.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to put my hand up and just confess to something, Brian. I have on this program stated over and over again that it doesn't feel right to me, dark energy as a concept. And I said, I am not an expert in this subject, but looking at and listening to astronomers talk about how they came about this, you essentially, how you came up with this theory of dark energy, I'm like, this doesn't feel right to me. And so I wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, some other people who say, maybe dark energy, maybe there are measurements that we're making that are not correct. Maybe that the constants aren't the constants that we think they are, or there are things that are modifying gravity out there. So there's a couple of different potential and lacking in the sort of evidence that you have, explanations that, or at least suggestions that there might be other ways that we figure out this this standard model. In other words, how all the pieces of our universe stick together. And I'm just wondering, what do you make of people who say, we may not need dark energy to explain the way our universe moves around?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm surprisingly agnostic on exactly what's going on. I'm a guy who goes out and measures things. And then you try to come up with the simplest solution to explain what you've measured. So when we measure that the universe seems to be speeding up, you know, I'm really into the details of making those measurements well. When you come to the explanation, it turns out the solution of dark energy is a single number that was in existence. The theory existed. You'd have to make anything new up. It's a single number you got to add. So it's very simple, and it makes very precise predictions you can go out and test. So that's kind of baseline theory. And yeah, I'll be honest, when we made the discovery, it didn't feel right to us either. We figured we must have screwed something up. So we did check our work quite a bit. And it turns out you make predictions. And since 1998, pretty much every prediction we've made has been verified. And so in the end, that's as good as science does. Science makes predictions, and as long as it keeps predicting the right answer, you're in good shape. However, in the last couple years, there's a couple things that look just a little wrong. When we compare how fast the universe seems to be expanding when the universe was only 380,000 years old, so very soon after the Big Bang, and how fast it's expanding now, we don't quite get they're off by 8%. We call this the Hubble tension. I'm not going to talk too much about this on Monday, but it is a crack. And it's a crack I do not understand. It might just be bad measurements, but my sense is there's something really serious going on there. More recently, we've started measuring the acceleration incredibly precisely back in time. And if you look at the numbers in detail right now, there appears to be a discrepancy at the 1 to 2% level. And I'm not sure I believe it yet, but if it were to be true, then we're going to need a more complicated solution. So in the end, you make the measurements as best you can. You compare them to your theory. And in physics, the beautiful thing of physics is you're either kind of right or you're wrong. And so if you get a measurement that is different than your theory says, you have a problem that you need to fix. So I think we're kind of in the middle of a situation where we might have a problem we need to fix. And so maybe it isn't quite dark energy, but I suspect it's something like dark energy, and it might be the dark energy's changing. I don't think you just give up and say, all of physics is wrong, dark, you know, general relativity is wrong, and we're going to start messing at the foundations of physics. But who knows? Maybe that's where it ends up going. It's hard to know.
If you've just joined us, we are very delighted to be joined by a Nobel Prize winning astronomer. His name is Brian Schmidt. He is literally the person who came up with the idea of dark energy to explain why our universe is expanding and continuing to grow. And that acceleration is that growth is accelerating, because that doesn't really tend to make a huge amount of sense. I am speaking with Brian, having spent probably 8 years on this program, saying, I don't think dark energy is right. And here I am face to face with the man himself. So in terms of measuring dark energy, like if it's a thing, are there any theories out there that you've gone, actually, that would be a really good experiment, in the same way that we have measured things like, you know, the particles that pass through the planet, neutrinos? Like we have come up with clever ways of capturing neutrinos with, you know, weird and bizarre experiments, right? Is there a way or a design that you think this hypothetical experiment might actually allow us to measure or capture or get an essence of what this energy is? Because that's the thing that I have a problem with. We have no way of knowing anything about it. And that kind of, I find that unsatisfactory.
It is very unsatisfactory. And dark energy's fundamental basis, in theory, if we want to use the Einstein, and you know, I only get credit for discovering, quite frankly, what Einstein predicted in 1917. So if you're going to blame anyone, you're going to have to blame Einstein, not me.
That's a good answer.
I'm just the messenger. don't shoot the messenger. So when we go out and we look at how can you measure dark energy, like you want to measure a neutrino, turns out dark energy only interacts via gravity. And gravity is a really, really weak force. So if you're going to go through, and this is where it starts giving you a sense of the problem, it turns out the universe is really big and the Earth is a very unusual place in the universe. So if you were to go through and say, how much dark energy is there in the Earth? The answer is about a microgram. So a millionth of a gram of material.
What?
Trying to do experiments on Earth, there's so much other stuff here, it completely swamps the dark energy. And so it's really hard to get a measurement in.
A microgram of dark energy on the whole planet.
The entire volume of the Earth.
That's crazy to me.
So it's crazy, but the universe is huge. And so the Earth is a very funny place in the universe. It turns out most of the universe has 30 orders of magnitude less stuff in it than the Earth has. So the Earth's a funny place. It's where all the mess is.
Wow. Well, I mean, that would explain why it's so difficult to measure. I can understand why building something to identify a microgram of a substance or of a force on an entire planet that's filled with lots of other much more powerful forces, I can see why that's a problem. I actually could speak with you for hours. This is such a fascinating conversation. If you want to hear Brian speak about this, he is giving a lecture at Maynooth University tomorrow evening. Tickets are free, but they're limited availability, of course, on Eventbrite. They will go very quickly, I would imagine, after this interview. So go and book now, because it's a very, very rare opportunity to meet someone who's done something so significant in our understanding of the universe, which is something that we talk about all of the time on the program. Brian, before we go, I have to do this because you, as an astronomer, you've done such incredible work. You know, you have won the Nobel Prize, the Shaw, the Gruber, the Breakthrough Prize. So there's probably, you know, not a prize you haven't won. But can I ask what it felt like when someone rang you from Sweden and said, yep, you got it?
Well, I was completely surreal. You don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I literally thought it was a practical joke. You know, someone said basically I had won the Nobel Prize. I didn't believe them. Then they put someone on who I knew from Sweden. And I was like, oh, wow. We don't really understand my discovery. Seemed like a kind of a crazy thing to give a Nobel Prize for. But, you know, you don't really have a choice in the matter. And your life kind of changes overnight. It's like saying, I love chocolate, and someone coming and giving you 10 tons of chocolate. And that's what winning a Nobel Prize is like. It's a lot.
What a brilliant description. And it's been really lovely to speak with you, Brian. And I'm sure our listeners understand why. Brian Schmidt, thank you so much for speaking with us on the program.
My pleasure, and I hope people still have doubts about dark energy after my talk. That's part of the point.
All right, it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week's or the last couple of weeks' podcasts. Michael says, I enjoy your show and admire how you promote gender diversity with the number of female contributors. Thank you for noticing, Michael, because it is something that we do try to do. I feel I have to comment on your piece on DEI and Trump, though. It's one thing to complain about the damage Trump is doing to science and vaccines, etc. But then you asked who could be against diversity, equality and inclusion. You hinted at the answer when you said some people think it's gone too far. I would love to challenge that, Michael, and just tell me, at what point has it gone too far? I did this radio program for, I think it was about eight or nine years. Have I talked about this already? Probably have. It was on Spin, right? And it was a daily talk show in which we just talk crap. We talk shite to young people about whatever was interesting. And sometimes we drop in a bit of politics, and sometimes we talk about serious issues, and we talk to a guy who knew he was going to die in the very short space of time. We did some serious stuff and we did some light stuff. But what it gave me was a really, really empathetic worldview. And it told me that life has been hard for a lot of people. And if we can not be judging people for what they do or how they feel or what they wear or who they're with, as long as it doesn't affect us, the idea that, you know, a certain wave is going to tear away at the fabric of society, that doesn't, I don't buy that. So, you know, when people talk about, you know, trans issues going too far, that makes no sense to me. If someone is not hurting you and they're in pain and they want to behave in a certain way and dress in a certain way and want to be treated in a certain way, why don't we just allow that? Like, why do we have any issues with that? I mean, almost all of the interventions that I've heard of over the years when it comes to DEI, it's just allowing a little bit of consideration for how someone else feels or wants to live their life. Sometimes it involves a very minor concession, like sharing a bathroom. For the most part, I know this is a trigger issue warning for a lot of people, but for the most part, I suppose, as a man, perhaps my opinion isn't as valid here. But I would challenge that the problem that is often thrown out there as people who are against this issue is not something that many people have experienced in the real world. And for me, I just feel like I don't know of any real examples that are gone too far, like woke gone too far. I just don't know what they mean. I'd love to hear what you think is going too far, Michael. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. I was turned very, very liberal by this radio program. And it was because I heard people's opinions over and over and over again. Every single one of the biases that I had, even though, of course, I still hold some, they were all challenged during that period. And I think it made me a much better person. Aideen says, you mentioned a WhatsApp group for science and Trump. Please add me to the WhatsApp group. We will, Aideen. Yeah, it's like a closed group. I get lots of requests for people wanting to join. I don't even know how they find it. But like, we have this massive like WhatsApp group of people talking about politics in America. Someone needs to build a product that's kind of like Twitter, but isn't Twitter. And I know you say Blue Sky, but it's not. It's hard to go back to what Twitter was. Twitter was cool. And Blue Sky, I haven't figured out the algorithm, I think. Hi, Jonathan. I love your podcast. Listen for years. I'm writing regarding the report about links between shingles vaccines and reduced dementia incidence. I was surprised Dr. Dungan did not look beyond these particular vaccines because there are actually similar correlations being noted with many vaccines. Please follow these links. You know, in fairness to our researchers, they're doing this in their, you know, like they don't have time to do a broad meta-analysis of the research that's out there. You know, Dr. Laura Dungan is an excellent doctor, communicator and immunologist. But we don't ask her to perform a literature review just to do the news round. So I will say, with that in mind, there are, it appears, a number of vaccines that do provide similar protection against Alzheimer's disease, which is actually really interesting. I would have thought that the numbers, because we heard last week that this vaccine that was mentioned gives, the shingles vaccine gives, you know, like 30%. Less likely to develop dementia. HZ vaccine mentioned in this piece, 25% reduced risk. The Tdap TD vaccine, I don't know what that is, but it's also 30% reduction in dementia. The new pneumococcal vaccine, 27% reduced risk of developing dementia. Like, a lot of vaccines seem to prevent or at least reduce the incidence of dementia. Crazy that I hadn't heard that before. Thank you so much for letting us know that, Phil. Once again, the power of vaccines. And if you're not getting vaccinated for these diseases, you may be missing out on other benefits, because the more we hear about viruses and bacteria, the more we realize that there are links to some of these, to more serious disease, that I think we're going to see more and more of these as the time goes on. So thank you so much for that, Phil. Well, thank you so much for your emails. We love them, by the way. If anything is on your mind, you just want to say something stupid, we would love to hear what you're thinking about, what we talk about in the program. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. Thank you to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, Hugo De Silva on sound, and to you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday, which is actually quite a good one, because we're going to be talking about robots that travel up your colon, and it's a good thing. That's in next week's podcast. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.